Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Naturalist, essayist, poet, philosopher Henry David Thoreau wrote his famous book, Walden, or Life in the Woods, a long time ago, and yet our guest this hour calls him the hero for our time. She also said that his book has become one of the most misunderstood American literary classics. She says most of us believe it's a story about a man who turned his back on the world to live in the wilderness. What we're missing is that he simply sought to live well at the time of technological change and increasingly partisan politics. If he found success in that endeavor, perhaps we could take a few tips from him that would improve our lives during a period very much like what Thoreau was living through in 1854. Well, that's the thesis behind Finding Your Walden, How to Strive Less, Simplify More, and Embrace What Matters Most. It's the work of local author Jen Tota McGivney, and we invited her to share her thoughts and Henry David Thoreau's with us this hour. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, nice to have you here. We're actually in the studio. It's an amazing thing. Before we talk about Henry David Thoreau and what he thought about and what he wrote about, you've written for a lot of different magazines, including Success and Southern Living, Our State, Charlotte Magazine, the late, great Charlotte Magazine, even Cancer Today. Mm-hmm. So you've done all this writing on these various different topics. What was it about Henry David Thoreau that was made him even on your radar?
I have loved Thoreau since I was a teenager. Walden has been my favorite book since I was a teenager. And I've always found it very relevant to this moment and to my life. But over the past 5 or 10 years, the relevance to this time has just grown because his time and our own time, the similarities are just striking. And so many of the questions that he devoted his life to are the same questions that a lot of us are asking, such as, how do you live well in a time this volatile, in a time that's changing so quickly? How do you live ethically in a time when there are so many unethical things going on? What are your duties and responsibilities in a time like this? But also, where are the opportunities for joy? And these are like big, daunting, heavy questions. And I think there's no better company for these questions than Henry David Thoreau.
And you called him a hero for our time.
I
said, you've also described him as your life coach. And you add, quote, almost every major decision I've made, which degree to pursue, when to accept or quit a job, where to live, including Charlotte, starts with an imaginary huddle with Thoreau. How does that help?
When you read Walden, Walden is not about Thoreau. Walden is about you, the reader. He makes it so personal. And I've read Walden, I can't even count how many times, but whenever I do, he really makes me question, are the decisions that I'm making me fully me, or are they making me just a little more like everyone else? Because he really challenges the reader to live a life according to your values and not to like mindlessly absorb the values of everyone around you. So I find that it's a hard challenge, but I find that a really good challenge.
And I'll bet you it's a harder challenge today for us than it would have been for him in 1854. I want to talk a little bit later on about the similarities between what was going on. Because it's hard to believe that there's any comparison to that. But you talk about this. I'm going to not say this right. you talk about in the opening, everybody thinks this book, his book, is about getting away from it all and never coming back. Just living in a life of solitude and self-indulgence, etc., away from other people. But you say in the opening three sentences of the book, he tells you, the reader, no, this is going to come to an end.
Yes.
And I'm only a mile away from the closest people that I associate with. Why do we have that misconception about what that book was all about?
I think part of it is there are so many wonderful quotes in Walden that it has been kind of condensed into quotes, and people know the quotes and not the context. And if you're just picking out a quote here and there, it sounds like he's all by himself in the woods. But when you read the book, you get a completely different impression.
And you say it's difficult. It's a difficult book for modern readers to read. I've never read it, but you say it's difficult to read, and I guess maybe for the same reason that we were talking about Hawthorne before the show. And I've read Hawthorne. Mm-hmm. It's a different style than we write in and read in today. Is that why it's difficult, or is it the ideas, or is it the fact that he's very punny?
He is very punny. And he also, he's very well read. So he's making references to so many things from like 14th century Persian pottery to old religious texts. I mean, he's having references everywhere. If you're going to read Walden, get a book that has footnotes. But I have tried to get so many of my friends to read Walden. I have gifted this book so many times to people who have expressed no interest in it. And with one exception, no one's read it. Everyone comes back and they're like, well, this isn't really a good time. So what I wanted to do was, what if I could write a book that takes the ideas out of Walden, takes them out of this dense 19th century text, and brings them into not only today's words and today's language, but today's lives, to show what does it look to live these ideas today?
Yeah, this is not just a repackaging of Walden. Your book is not just a repackaging of Walden. In fact, you took the time to interview a lot of different people about for this book. What did you interview them about? What questions did you ask? Who were these people? Because I guess they've read his book too, huh?
None of them.
None of them. Well, then that begs the question, why did you talk to these people?
The experts I interviewed, of course, did. The academic experts did, but the regular people usually did not. So what I did with Walden, Finding Your Walden, I took these five principles of Walden. I made five principles, and what did they look like for Thoreau? But what can they look like today? So that's where all the interviews came in, where I interviewed people about how they live these Thoreau-like lives today, whether it's a small like life hack, a small practice like a meditation practice, or maybe it's a major life experiment like a year-long sabbatical. Mm. I wanted to have a whole menu of things from very simple to very big to show like this is what it could look like today.
I don't know anybody like that. How did you find these people?
Oh, my gosh. You just ask around, ask questions. I was searching online and reaching out to people. And it's funny. Once you find someone else, and it takes you on a journey.
Talk to anybody who was involved in the rat race and didn't know how to get out of it?
Yes. I spoke to a woman. Her name's Katrina McGee. Mm-hmm. And she graduated. She got her MBA. She was doing all the responsible things, and she was very much a part of the rat race. And then she hit her early 30s, and she realized that this is a really good life, but it's not my life. This is not the life I should be living. And she didn't have much money. I think she had like $1,500 in her bank account. But she was able to save up to go on a sabbatical because she wanted to know, who am I when I'm not working, to take that break. And it changed her life. And like now she went back and she had a corporate job, but now she's a sabbatical coach and she helps other people take that break. Because a lot of people just, we don't know who we are when we're not working. Like, who are you when you're not a lawyer? Who are you when you are not a project manager to rediscover, like, what do you want to do? Who are you?
Yeah, I found that out early in my career, because there are two kinds of people in broadcasting. There are those who have been fired, and there are those who are waiting to be fired. And the first time I lost a job, I thought, who am I? Mm. Seriously, mm-hmm. I was out of job. It took about 6 months to find a new job.
Right.
And I thought, well, who am I? If I'm not the guy on the radio, who am I?
Right.
And I thought, well, that's a stupid way to live. Mm-hmm. So I've never felt that way since.
Well, that's good. there's a term for that. It's called enmeshment, where we kind of confuse our identities with our job title or our self-worth or our salary. And it's so easy to fall into that trap. And that's one reason I love Thoreau. He really focuses on, like, who are you when no one's looking? Who are you when it's just you?
So you love his book. You love his ideas. Mm-hmm. His book, you say, is not an easy read. And you admit for years you tried to get other people to read the book and failed. And you also tried to get, I think, a magazine or a publisher to be interested in your idea for a book. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work until you approached Success Magazine. Mm-hmm. And you suggested an article on how his message can improve people's work lives. That worked.
It
led to the article, and that led to this book. So tell us, how can his philosophy improve our work life? Not our time away from the office, but our work life.
I would say part of it is knowing the difference between work life and real life. What Thoreau, I think one thing people will be surprised about Thoreau is how pragmatic he was, because he's known as an idealist, but he was a very much pragmatic idealist. And he was willing to do the work he needed to do to make the money he needed to make, but he never confused his work with his identity. Like, we know him as a writer, but for most of his life, he worked as a land surveyor in order to make money, in order to live. But he never thought, you know, I am Thoreau, land surveyor. No, he was always a writer at heart. He was just willing to do the work he needed to do, whether it was a fence post digger or a town handyman. He had all sorts of jobs. One lesson that I think is fantastic to learn from him as far as work life is the art of quitting. He was a great quitter, and that's the reason why we know him today, because he knew when to quit, when to walk away from an opportunity, when you have extracted everything you can out of one opportunity, when it's time to walk away and start the next one. I have quit a job because I know David Thoreau, and this one line in particular, he wrote when he was leaving, I left the woods for as good a reason as I went there. Perhaps it seemed to me that I had several more lives to live, and I could not spare any more time for that one.
Wow.
I love that quote.
How old was he when he did this?
28. He was 28 to 30 while he was there.
That seems like an awful young age to want to get away from it all, to find out who you are because you're overwhelmed by work. And let's be honest here. It's 1854. Mm-hmm. He was a land surveyor, and his father owned a pencil factory, and he was involved in the pencil factory at some point because evidently the pencil factory, I don't know why, maybe computers were coming online and people didn't need pencils anymore. But the pencil factory was going through some hard times, so he helped his father out at the factory. And that is part of the reason he got away, right? I mean, he was too enmeshed in this day-to-day life, this work life?
A bit, but a bit more than that. I think he had spent his 20s doing all of the responsible things. You know, he was this poor kid who got a scholarship to Harvard, and then he gets out and he gets a good job as a teacher, and then he's a working writer, and then he's working to support his parents. He helped his mom buy a house. He helped his dad's business. And he had done all of the responsible things. But he was just thinking, why isn't it possible to make a good living and to live a good life? Why can't there be more joy in life when you're also paying your bills? So he just wanted to step away and think, am I living it right? How can I be doing this better?
He's also, we think of him as being a successful writer because of this book. But his first book was not successful. And you say that he went to New York. Even back then, 1854, you had to go to New York, to be a writer. And he got a room on Staten Island, which is a hike from Manhattan, particularly in 1854. Yeah. You still have to take the ferry. And I guess back then, what was it, a rowboat? I don't know. But he lived on, the deal was that he would teach the owner of the house their children. For in exchange for room and board. And he didn't like the family. And I guess they didn't like him. But he would go into New York and try to get his writing, get an agent to get his writing published. And evidently you say that just like today, there were more writers than there was need for them. Let's put it that way. And he discovered that. How did he get the second book published if the first one failed?
He had a hard time with it. The first one went so poorly, he actually went into debt over the book. And not only did he not make money, he went into debt. And then when he wrote Walden, a lot of people passed on it. Like, he could not find a publisher for it. And he finally did. But even then, when he died, not many people knew who he was. He was not the name that he is today.
Wow. I guess the publisher who said okay to Walden struck it rich, at least initially. I mean, I'm sure it's in public domain now. Nobody's making any money on it, are they?
I guess not. I mean, there's got to be so many editions, but I think it has been continuously in print since 1854.
So I want to talk about life in 1854 and the comparisons that you see between his time and our time. When we come back from the break, our guest today is Jen McGivney. She's the author of Finding Your Walden, How to Strive Less, Simplify More, and Embrace What Matters Most, Five Principles for Modern Living from Henry David Thoreau. We'll get into that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. As part of the middle school Think Lab curriculum, students engage in hands-on, project-based learning focused on real-world problems. Information at BIS Charlotte. www.thoreauthor.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Jen Toto-McGivney. Her book is called Finding Your Walden, How to Strive Less, Simplify More, and Embrace What Matters Most. It's about Henry David Thoreau. He wrote Walden, or Life in the Woods, in 1854, and a lot of people would think that was an infinitely simpler time with few, if any, parallels to what we are living through today. It was pre-Civil War. Correct me if I'm wrong. It was pre-Industrial Revolution. And in terms of technology, I didn't look this up. I just tried to think yesterday. Technologically speaking, what was going on? They had a railroad, I guess, the beginnings of the railroad. I guess they had a steamboat. I think that was going on. Cotton gin, maybe. Other than that, I can't think of anything that was technological in his time. But you say we could sit down with him and have a relatable conversation and find commonalities despite this 175-year divide. How so?
100%. There was this 30-year period during Thoreau's life where technology advanced faster in that period than it had in the previous hundreds of years combined, and it was mostly due to the railroad and the telegraph.
Ah, forgot the telegraph.
They sound quaint now, right? Yeah. They sound so quaint, but at the time, think of what it meant, where hundreds and hundreds of years before, the fastest that a person or information could travel would be as fast as a horse could gallop.
Right.
In this 30-year period, suddenly, people could travel across a state within hours. Information could travel across the country within seconds. It changed everything about how people lived and worked and communicated. So there's this period where people are just trying to keep up with all the changes. And in addition to that, we have industrial capitalism taking off. So we have all these factories, and work is becoming a lot less human and a lot more machine, right? And then you can make so much stuff. So companies suddenly need to sell so much stuff and convince people that they need to buy it. So consumerist culture is really taking off.
I mean, today we are inundated with stuff on our phones, on our computers. We are tweeting or Xing or whatever it is. Instagram, TikTok, blah, blah, blah. We have radio. We have mass communication. They didn't have any of that. They had the telegraph, but I would think that most people were not touched even on a yearly basis by the telegraph, except for the fact that the telegraph enabled newspapers to print things that were happening right now. And the newspaper came out, what, once a day?
That's funny that you mentioned that, okay. Mike, because in Thoreau's time, paper got cheaper. And for the first time, there could be a morning newspaper and an afternoon paper. And Thoreau, this drives him crazy in Walden. He's like, who would need to read the news twice a day? Like, can you imagine reading the news twice a day? Like, imagine him coming today and he'll be like, how many times you follow the news? But his concern was, if you're following the news that closely, you're going to know what's going to happen on the other side of the world more than you're going to know what's going to happen with your own neighbor. And so again, history doesn't repeat, but it definitely rhymes.
So yeah, that was his quote, right? So what was I going to say? Everything is relative, is what I was going to say. Yeah. Everything is relative. So for them, these developments were to them as mind-numbing as ours are to us today.
Yes.
Somebody will have this conversation in 175 years and look back at us the same way that we're talking about their time.
Right.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was I was so tired of hearing people say, in these unprecedented times, like how many times have we heard people say, like, in these unprecedented times? And I feel like it's such an anxiety-producing thing to say, where, like, nothing like this has ever happened to anyone ever before, right. And you're completely on your own in time and history. And I just wanted to point to Thoreau and be like, here, meet someone who has.
Well, the title of your first chapter is In These Unprecedented Times, which is a refreshing word, given the exact thing that you've just said, that we're always and we are living through unprecedented times. There's no question about it, particularly when it comes to politics. But I suppose that the idea that others have been where we are should be comforting?
I think so, especially when they left behind books to help us. And I think the trick is taking advantage of these books that are helping us. You know, last year in 2025, 40% of Americans didn't read a single book. And Thoreau is talking in Walden that not enough people are reading the books because there's so much wisdom to be had if we go back and connect with previous generations.
Mm. And those are books. Yes. It's very different. Yeah, but most people don't read anything they can't scroll in 5 seconds on their phone. And if they can't get to the meat of it in 5 seconds, they're on to the next thing. They're swiping left or right or whichever way you swipe. I don't know. Despite being able to apply some of the principles that he wrote about and the fact that his time was different from ours, despite the parallels, less complicated, less technological, less materialistic. He writes about materialism, and he's trying to get away from it, which I want to talk about. But is it more difficult because our times are more complex and we have more stuff, technological stuff, physical, materialistic stuff? Is it more difficult for us to apply some of the things that he concluded worked for them in their time?
Yes, and I believe that's why it's so important to revisit these ideas. And I think another reason is attention as a resource. Like, so much of our attention is dominated by so many things. We have so many things vying for our attention. And what Thoreau wanted to do at Walden was to get just far enough away, just long enough away to have a break from his routine and basically hear himself think. And it's really hard unless you get away to differentiate your values and your goals, right? Because your goals are the things that you want to do, and your values are the person, that how you want to live, mm-hmm. whether or not you achieve your goals. And what Thoreau was doing was getting some space to make sure, am I living my values and not just my goals? And I think today, because we're so inundated with things that are vying for our attention, it's really hard to not live a life where we're just chasing the next goal and neglecting our values.
He was complaining about people not reading classic literature enough, yes. and not enough books. Yes. And today, as I just said, people don't read books at all in many cases, and they don't read newspapers at all. They get their news from their phone. They get tidbits of information, lifestyle information from their phone, and it's real quick stuff. It's not deep. And then you have Henry David Thoreau, which is not easy to read.
No.
And many people perhaps have never read him. Some people don't even know who the heck we're talking about, have never heard his name before. So still you say that we can distill him down to a bumper sticker, simplify, but that's unfair
yes.
to him and to his philosophy. There's a lot more to him. So talk about that. Is it just getting away from things so you can evaluate the things you have?
I think that's a step. I think that's part of it. But when he was saying simplify, we focus so much on what he was simplifying that we are not focusing on what he simplified for. Mm-hmm. The point wasn't to have and to do as little as possible. The point was to have and to do as much as possible that had value to him and that mattered to him. And what I brought that into my book as pare down to trade up. How can you pare down in some aspects of your life in order to trade up in others? So how can you pare down with things that really don't matter to you so much in order to invest that time, energy, and money into things that do?
Yeah, he also said that he lived in a fast-changing, conflict. Well, you said mm-hmm. he lived in a fast-changing, conflict-ridden, overpriced world.
Yeah.
I'm just curious about, we talked about how fast-changing it was. Mm-hmm. Overpriced, how? They had nothing to buy, did they?
No, actually not true. It's funny. Back to paper getting cheap, magazines were taking off.
Okay.
And the home magazine really took off. And suddenly houses weren't something that you just lived in. It was something that you showed off, that really showed your status. And people were investing a lot of money in homes. And Thoreau in Walden is really preoccupied. Like, is it worth buying a house? Should I just rent? He's asking the question that like almost every young person's asking right now. And he determined to be a lifelong renter because he said people are spending so much on the homes that they're living in. They're living in debt their entire lives. And he's like, are you at that point living in a house? Are you imprisoned in it?
Nothing has changed.
Nothing has changed.
Just the prices. He would be appalled.
Can you imagine?
I can't imagine. But you say he traded up. He pared down.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute. He pared down to trade up. Yeah. Is that what? Mm-hmm. I get it backwards sometimes.
You got it.
One description of your book, Finding Your Walden, is that it is a self-help book for modern times, taking cues from a bygone era. How do you feel about that description? And if it's at all accurate, is his book a self-help book for his time?
Feel it's a bit misleading.
Okay.
For both of the books, the good news and the bad news is that there are no answers. There are no answers about how you should live in these books. There are a whole lot of questions that you should be asking yourself, because Thoreau believed that if you're living a life according to your values, your life is going to look different than my life, and it's going to look different than everyone else's. So where you get into trouble is if your life suddenly looks like everyone around you. So what he's saying is you really need to delve into these questions, delve into yourself to realize what is the best life for you to live. So self-help might be a bit misleading, because it's really not telling you to do anything. It's telling you to question everything.
He's also saying it's okay to be you.
You have to be you, right? He was one of the Transcendentalists, and the Transcendentalists believed that everyone is born with like this good nature, this divine spark, and you should spend your entire life making sure you're tapping into that and you're tapping into your intuition to do what's best for you.
A lot of people, but let's talk about this first. Let's talk about Thoreau and the fact that a lot of people believe that he was this hermit who lived in the woods by himself. And who would do that? Why would you do that? I mean, but maybe living in the woods in 1854 in a cabin wasn't that much different from living in the town. They had no electricity. They had no running water. They had no bathrooms. What difference does it make? But nonetheless, he did not live in the woods for all that long.
2 years.
2 years. I think it's 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days.
100%. Yep.
Why? Was there some code to that? 222?
He said it was just coincidence. And the first day he went out there was July 4th. And he contends it was mere coincidence it was Independence Day when he went out there, and I do not believe him.
But it was not a lifelong pursuit.
Right.
He returned to the world and to his regular life as a land surveyor and a writer. But he returned, you say, with an understanding of what he really needed in that world. And the word that you use, perhaps it was his, is enough.
Yes.
Are you saying that he learned how to gauge when enough is enough?
I think that was the point of his Walden Pond experience. And I think we can learn so much from it now, because we live in this culture of accumulation that's always more, right? If we just work a little bit more, then we can have a little bit more, we can earn a little bit more, and like become a little bit more. And we're always focused on what's next. And you can't win a game with a moving goalpost. And what Thoreau is offering up is, what if instead we define enough? And then when we achieve enough, we can slow down a bit and enjoy life more. And the trick is, the less that you need to have enough, the faster you get there.
So that was his purpose, going into the woods to see how little he could have to get by and live a comfortable life.
Right.
Is he trying to destroy the economy?
I think he's not at all worried about the economy. I think he's very worried about his own life and happiness, and I'll take a page from that.
So a lot of people would describe their lives that they live today as a rat race. Some people would like to get off the treadmill. Mm-hmm. Others thrive. I know that for a long time, I thrived on how packed my schedule was, and I felt like I'm really accomplishing something here. It's giving me purpose, and I can't wait till the next appointment. That's 5 minutes from now, and I haven't finished this. Okay, I'm on to the next thing. But we are among the most productive people in the world in terms of workers in America. We're the kind of people that don't take vacations, or we take our work on vacations, and we take our work on weekends. And now that the internet is here and computers have enabled this, we never have to stop working.
Right.
We can always be responsive. And I know a person who is that way right now. Thoreau, you would encourage people to take a step back and examine that. And you've alluded to this earlier in this conversation, that we are not our work, but we should know what we work for.
Right.
Isn't that interesting?
Right.
What did he work for?
There were three things that he really invested his time in. And I think it's really important not to only look at what he simplified for, but what Thoreau lived for. And it was his relationships with his family and his community. It was his activism. He was an operative on the Underground Railroad all of his life and a very outspoken abolitionist. And it was his time in nature and his research in nature. So he was able to pare down enough where he can live a life where he was full of all of these things he loved to do and that gave him joy.
You've done a little of this. We talked about this before we went on the air, and you talk about it, I think, in your book. It's certainly in an article that I read about you, where you lived in Washington and you decided at some point, not too long ago, mm-hmm. to simplify things. Mm-hmm. You chose Charlotte mm-hmm. because it was a slower pace and housing was more affordable, et cetera, than the D.C. area. How did you discover what you work for, and how would you suggest we do that?
I think to be aware that it changes. I think we're all seasonal workers. I think there are different seasons of our lives where we're working for different things, and to acknowledge when that changes. I love D.C. The corporate job was great for a while, but there was a point where, kind of like Thoreau, I extracted what I needed from that experience, and mm-hmm. there was another life I wanted to live, and to realize that, okay, it's time to start the next thing. And that's another reason I love about Thoreau talking about quitting, because you can't start a new chapter until you end an old one.
Were you able to do that because, as you said, you have been a Thoreau fan and you read his book many times since you were 14. So yeah. You've kind of engulfed yourself in his philosophy. Is that why you were able to see that in yourself and make that move in yourself?
I think so. And it's kind of chicken and egg. Is it because I am like that I was attracted to Thoreau so much and like his writing, or did Thoreau change the way I was thinking? And I'm not quite sure.
There are people who know the price of everything and not the value and the value of nothing. Right. And Thoreau came to that understanding in a kind of a different angle. It is not just how much money we spend. This really leapt out to me. It's not how much money we spend to achieve the life we want. It's about how much energy we spend, how much time we spend. And here's what leapt out at me. How much life we spend to earn and spend the money that we earn. Life is limited.
Yes.
Life is short. Making that calculation, what's it worth to me, is a very personal decision. So what can Henry David Thoreau, and by extension you, mm-hmm. teach us about how to arrive at the answer to that?
I call this Waldenomics. It's a term I made up to describe exactly what you're talking about, Mike. I think the most important sentence in Walden is, I'm paraphrasing, that the cost of a thing is the amount of life that we're willing to trade for it. And what I love there is he's redefining currency. Like you said, we're not just spending money. We're spending our time and our energy and our attention, and that we need to put all of those into the calculation, and it really changes the math. And like you said, it's deeply personal. It's going to be different for every person. Like, what is this job worth? What is this house worth? Like, it's going to cost everyone a slightly different thing. And just to be very honest about how much life are you trading for this thing?
I think that's a question we never think about. And maybe Europeans do or other cultures do, but I don't think in America we think about that.
And Thoreau, he had tuberculosis. Here was someone who knew he was not going to have a long life. So for him, I'm guessing his most important currency was his time. But I would say it's that way for all of us, right? I mean, we need to focus on our time as well.
Well, I got to go.
We're out. Time to go live some life.
Actually, I do have to go. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more. We'll be back. Jen Tota McGivney is our guest, author of Finding Your Walden. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Jen Tota McGivney is our guest. She has written a book called Finding Your Walden, How to Strive Less, Simplify More, and Embrace What Matters Most. She has essentially put a modern spin on Henry David Thoreau's book of 1854, which, as she admits, is difficult to read for some people, but clearly well worth reading. I'm still stuck on this. Analyzing what you do and how much of your life that you're spending to acquire things. He encouraged people of his time not to become slaves of the machine. I mean, his father owned a pencil factory, for crying out loud. And to understand what true wealth was to him, what was it? Just these relationships and the time to do what he wanted to do? I mean, it seems a little selfish.
You know, but balancing that with his work as an operative on the Underground Railroad. He was,
okay.
I mean, he went to jail for his work opposing slavery. He was an operative on the Underground Railroad. Even after the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 meant that he would have been imprisoned and bankrupted for the work. He stood up for John Brown and memorialized John Brown after he died, even when a mob of 500 people threatened to show up with guns and, like, keep him from talking. So even though he had this life that he enjoyed with his hobbies and his friends, he also felt a deep sense of social justice, that there was so much going on in the world that needed his attention, and he lived a lot of his life facing that and opposing that.
You write that, quote, "We're told that work should be our passion, which makes overtime feel more like a sacrament than a sacrifice." Wow. Social media transforms our time, our lives, into engagements to be monetized. Consumerism makes everything available for purchase. New devices are sold to streamline our lives, but they distract us from them. But this is modern society. It's a modern economy. Can you successfully fight those forces and still have money to afford to live and to live a life and not be considered by your neighbors to be a Luddite?
I think part of it is, oh, I have two parts to this. One, yes, it is possible. And I've heard from so many people who are saying that this is speaking to my moment right now. I want to simplify. I want to pare down. I want to stop caring so much about things I really don't care about. Mm-hmm. Like, we have these external markers of success, right? Like the car we drive, the house we live in, the clothes we wear. And it costs so much of our time and our money, of our life, to keep up with these external markers of success. And I think more and more people are thinking, well, what is my own idea of success? What does success look like for me? What do I really care about? Because when you hone in on that, you can spend much more of your time caring about that.
Other cultures, Italians come to mind.
Yeah.
If you go to Italy, there's a time of day you can't go into a shop because they're taking a long lunch or a siesta. They have a late dinner and they walk the Corso for hours just to walk off the dinner. They live a life that's aimed at enjoying the life they live.
It doesn't have to be this way.
Yeah, and we don't seem to do that. How is this different? We've had some minimalists on this program before.
Okay.
One of them you quote in either in the book or in one of the articles. Who looked at life and they pared down and they put all their stuff in a cart in the cardboard boxes to see what of their stuff they actually need.
Right.
And when they realized, okay, I don't need this, I don't need that, it's in the box, it's been in the box for a year, I'm throwing the box.
Get rid of it. Yep.
how is this different from that?
How is
his philosophy of life and what you're advocating different from minimalism as we've come to know it in the modern culture?
I think minimalism is part of it. Minimalism is one way it can be done. But I think overall, as a sense of intentionality, whatever that means to you, Joshua Becker.
Oh,
he's great.
Yeah.
He really popularized the minimalism movement in the early 2000s. And I spoke to him for the book. And he said, "I never intended it to go extreme. Like, minimalism is owning the right number of things for you at this stage of your life." And again, that's going to be different for everyone.
He was on this program.
He's fantastic,
isn't
he?
Fantastic, yeah.
Yes.
Thoreau wrote, quote, "Most of the luxuries and many of the so-called comforts of life are not only not indispensable, but positive hindrances to the elevation of mankind." Yikes. And you point out that he encourages us to disentangle our measure of self-worth from the stuff we've accumulated. You've already just kind of alluded to that.
Mm-hmm.
But that takes some real soul searching. And it takes a whole new mindset because we've been raised in this materialistic, consumer-driven economy culture where having a BMW is a mark of success.
I think people are tired. I think people are exhausted and they're realizing there's something of more value than the stuff that they have and the titles that they have. I think this is a society that will always remind us of our potential as workers and consumers, but it's really up to us to realize our potential as humans, even if that means disengaging and looking a little different from everyone. And one thing I think about with Thoreau, a lot of his neighbors thought he was a total weirdo. Like,
yeah.
Can't you just get a regular job and a big house and nice clothes like everyone else and live a respectable life? And I think now, like, what if he did? What if he had? Like, you and I would not be talking about him right now.
Right.
Hundreds of thousands of people wouldn't be going to Walden Pond. It's like almost a pilgrimage. We're so in awe of someone who is willing to be himself. And what I love about that, Mike, is that what is the potential that we have? Like, if we truly live lives that met our values and allowed us to be ourselves, like, what potential could we realize?
I have a note about him being a weirdo, and oh, here it is. Because it was him, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that coined the phrase marching to a different drummer.
Yes.
It wasn't Linda Ronstadt. she stole from him. He has been criticized, as you say, for being a weirdo, for being antisocial. You say he was someone who dared to be his own person and dared others to be as well.
Yes.
You write about that in a chapter called Embrace Your Inner Misfit. To stand apart while standing tall is a superpower. That's the name of the chapter. That's your philosophy, right?
Yes, and it was my favorite chapter to write. And there's actually research on this about people who are willing to be different are happier people. They're more creative, they're more original, and they actually spark people around them to be more creative and original too. It's a happier lifestyle. Like, you can live a life that looks like everyone else, or you can, like, realize you can embrace your inner misfit.
So for people who have bought into this, who had never given it a second thought, because that's just how Americans live,
mm-hmm.
with a bigger house, you got to, you know, as you point out in the book, and I mean, I grew up in a house that was probably 1,500 square feet,
mm-hmm.
And there were five of us in that house. People today are in 3,000 square feet houses, and they could be a couple whose kids have gone off to live their own lives someplace, but they keep the house. It could be 4,000 square feet.
Right.
And we have a couple of cars, and we have four or five televisions because we want one in every room, and we have all this stuff. You pared down. You moved to Charlotte. You have a smaller house than you had, or you have a house,
mm-hmm.
but you didn't have a house in D.C. You have a different car, maybe not quite as nice as mm-hmm. the car you had when you had a corporate job in D.C. How did you flip the switch? How did you maintain your sense of success? And so I am who I am, and I'm successful, and I'm doing what I want to do, so I'm happy. How did you do that without the same materialistic things that you had before?
I think in the beginning, when you're paring down, you see what you're sacrificing. When you're trading up, you see what you're gaining. And to have a lifestyle now where I can pop back in my garden in the afternoon and do some gardening and have the time to meet friends for coffee and meet up with friends for drinks after work.
Mm.
Once you trade up, you see the things that you were giving up in order to have things that you really didn't care about. And what I like to focus on, am I doing something in order to live well, to live better, or am I doing something to seem a certain way? Because I think there are so many things we do just in order to seem a certain way, and they can really get in the way of the stuff that matters.
I want to come back to this idea that he had about how you spend your life.
Yeah.
What was the phrase? I'm trying to find it, and I can't.
The cost of a thing is the amount of life that we're willing to trade for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On that's on the one hand. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, after you examine the meaninglessness of some of the commercial things and the material things that you accumulate because you work your fanny off to get them, he does recommend spending life lavishly.
Lavishly.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think I know what it means, but you tell me what it means, because that is amazing to think about how we should be doing that, because life is finite.
Right. And he uses that word in the book, lavishly. And this is when you spend, like, if Waldenomics is about paring down to trade up, this is when you spend your Waldenomics profit and you really live a life that looks like your own and really includes all of the things that you care about. And that's, again, he wasn't minimizing to have less. He was minimizing to have more.
Yeah.
And taking it back to Joshua Becker, whom we spoke about, he wrote that everyone is a minimalist already. It's just what we're choosing to minimalize.
That's true.
Sometimes we're minimizing time with our family and friends. Sometimes we're minimizing work. Sometimes you have to choose what it is that you're choosing to minimize.
In talking about the same thing we just talked about, spending mm-hmm. life lavishly, you use a different word. You talk about savoring.
Savoring.
Another word that's not often used.
Isn't it a great word?
It's a great word.
Right.
I mean, to savor the life you live, the moments of your life, intention.
Attention, yeah. Attention and intention, yes.
Yeah.
Anne Lamott, who's another one of my favorite writers, has a great phrase. She talks about spending big round hours. And I think about how I have never gotten a notification on my phone for a big round hour. You know, like a big round hour, you have to take the time to do that yourself. You have to step away from things that are constantly pulling at your sleeve and trying to get your attention. I'm like, I need a big round hour.
I want to talk about something that I never thought I would ever talk about because I didn't know about it until I read it in your writing. Let me preface it by saying this. One of the things that pops out in terms of how living life, savoring life, spending life lavishly is that we only get about 4,000, was it weeks?
Yes. Isn't that devastating?
4,000 weeks on the planet.
4,000 weekends, 4,000 Taco Tuesdays. It's all finite. Yeah.
So when you say it like that, it really emboldens, italicizes, double underlines the need to spend your life lavishly and to savor the moments in life that mean the most to you.
Yes.
And here's where we get to the part I never thought we would discuss.
Oh, gosh.
Because not everybody has the time to take the four-hour walks every day.
Who does, right?
He wrote about corpse meditation, or you write about corpse
yes.
meditation. Corpse meditation.
Corpse meditation.
Something that Buddhist monks engage mm-hmm. in. How is meditating in the presence of a corpse? How does that help?
So there is a
and how many opportunities do you have to do that?
The point is to realize that your body is of the same nature as that body.
Right.
Your body is going to one day decompose just like that body. There's a meditation, and I'm going to get the wording wrong now, where you meditate. My body is of the nature to get sick. My body is of the nature to get frail. And you're really pondering, like, you have a finite body, and this is going to happen. But it really puts you in the moment of right now, you're here. So eventually, you're going to be there. So really take advantage of the moments that you have on the fortunate side of corpse meditation.
it's kind of eye-opening. I mean, when you think about the 4,000 weeks and you
yes.
think about that body that you're looking at while you're meditating on your own position in life is something you're working toward.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And as long as you're not that, you should live this.
And I think we're at this period now of the great reassessment. Like there was the great resignation during the pandemic when everyone was quitting their jobs. And now it seems like we're at this great reassessment where so many of us are asking, am I living it right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there something I should be doing differently, knowing how finite everything is and how packed full of stuff and events our lives are? Am I living it right, and what can I do different? And again, that's all Thoreau wrote about in his life, and that's why he's such wonderful company right now.
So Thoreau lived in that cabin in the woods, as you say, for 26 months, just over 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
He never intended for it to be permanent.
Mm-hmm.
It was an experiment. It was an exercise to figure out what he wanted to do, to how to live a better life when he got back to life.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to answer the questions, what really matters, what doesn't matter. You say his book doesn't answer those questions, and neither does yours. So did he find the answers?
Yes.
Have you?
I would say, we'll start with Thoreau. I would say yes, and part of the reason is he died so well. I mean, he died tragically young. He was 44. He had
yeah.
tuberculosis. And one of his friends went to see him on his deathbed. And he's like, I've never seen someone dying with so much peace. And even Thoreau said on his deathbed, he was dying without any regrets. And I really think, to borrow a phrase of his, he sucked the marrow out of life. You know, he got every bit of goodness out of that life, and I think he lived it right. And he died not knowing that he would become a famous writer, and I don't even know that he would have so much cared about it, but he lived the way he wanted to live. He made a massive impact in terms of social justice. Like his essay, Civil Disobedience, shaped Martin Luther King and Gandhi, the Nazi resistance. Here was someone, by living a life that was his own, changed the world.
Mm. If, as you say, both his book and yours provoke more questions than they answer, where does that leave us?
Always questioning. And I think it's good to always question, you know, am I living it right? Am I doing what I need to do? Am I supporting people around me who need to be supported? I think it's when we don't ask questions that we get in trouble.
The point of separating from the world is not to be alone, it's to find yourself. Mm-hmm. And you write, when we take a moment to separate from the world, we begin to discover our own thoughts, regain our interiority, who we are really. What do we think about when our minds have space to wander? What do we value? What seems less important? He took 26 months to get to that. We don't have that kind of time anymore to accomplish that. Can you do it in increments, day by day by day by day?
Absolutely. And I wanted to make this book accessible. And one of the best ways you can do that is a meditation practice. With 10, 15 minutes a day, you can actually retrain your brain and rewire your brain to calm down and to focus and to think. So what I wanted to do with Finding Your Walden, you know, you don't have to go out into the woods for 2 years to find the answers, but you do need to find little spaces and pockets of time.
And go ahead.
And those are accessible to us. We can fight for those.
Finding Your Walden, How to Strive Less, Simplify More, and Embrace What Matters Most. It's the work of our guest today, Jen Toda McGivney. I got to quit this job.
No. No.
Thank you for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.